Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Our guest today is not only one of the most active leaders in the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, but one of the world experts on the practice of CPR and the science of resuscitation. Just to touch on a few of his highlights, he's been affiliated with the IAED since 1992, when the MPDS was implemented in his center in Quebec. He'd been the chair of the NAED Board of Accreditation from 1996 to 2001. He was the president of the Academy from 2003 to 2005 and was chair of the College of Fellows until just last year, and he's currently the chair of the IAED Council of Research. In addition to his work with the Academy, he's chaired the Emergency Cardiac Care Committee for the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada. He's a member of the Basic Life Support Committee with the American Heart Association. He's a member of the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation and participated in two major revisions of the International CPR Guidelines. Finally, since 1996, he has been a member of the Board of Directors for the Citizen CPR Foundation. Welcome, Mark Gay. Thank you for joining us. He'll be joining us via Skype today.
Thank you.
So before we talk about any specific research, I was hoping that you would tell us a little bit about CPR recommendations, CPR guidelines. So a lot of people who work in dispatch centers know that there are these guidelines out there. They're aware that there are these recommendations from different organizations. Can you tell us a little bit about how those come into being?
Yes. Actually, since approximately 20 years ago, the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation that encompasses all of the resuscitation councils that have a organized council around the world. So, namely, the American Heart Association, European Resuscitation Council, Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, etc. So those that have a organized resuscitation council. So the scientists get together and every 5 years, and they review the science and they come up with some research questions on CPR. And once that's done for all aspects of CPR, for basic life support, advanced life support, pediatric life support, neonatal life support, then they research these and they look at the evidence, and then they would grade the levels of evidence. Now, there are many levels of evidence. The highest level of evidence is the large randomized controlled trials with humans. Mostly we have studies that are related to animal studies, which is a level 6 down the line. And then from those levels of evidence, then the international community would then set some classes of recommendation. And then from there on, a class one recommendation is approved by all scientists because of the levels of evidence and the supporting literature or documentation. And as we go down the line there, for example, a class three recommendation would not be a favorable recommendation. So that's the process of determining the guidelines. So whenever there's new science, then we would look at that and grade the evidence and then bring forth a class of recommendation. And then it's disseminated through all resuscitation councils around the world. And then they are then responsible for implementing those new specific guidelines.
Huh. Okay. So interesting. Well, one of the things that you mentioned there was levels of evidence, and you talked about randomized controlled trial, which means that you have a number of different groups. Some of them are control groups. Some of them get the intervention. And that's kind of the highest level of evidence. And then it goes all the way down to animal studies. Can you tell us a little bit more about where the evidence is on CPR? Which levels of evidence do we have, and why it's so difficult to do a randomized controlled trial for CPR?
Well, First of all, there are no ethics committee nowhere in the world that will approve studying resuscitation or cardiac arrest with humans, because it's just non-ethical. You cannot just give treatment to one and not give to another.
Right, because a randomized trial would mean that some people don't get the intervention at all. Some people wouldn't get CPR.
Exactly. So basically, we have to rely on animal studies. We know that most of the laboratories in North America, at least from my knowledge, they do studies on animals, which are mainly pigs and dogs. And physiologically and hemodynamically, in terms of blood flow, we know that basically we can compare that to human beings, and we will then extrapolate and draw some conclusions. So this is why sometimes we struggle a little bit with medicine, because medicine is a very strict science where we need to have evidence-based guidelines, and those evidence-based guidelines often we cannot get to that because we don't have any randomized control trials with humans. Therefore, we have to extrapolate and use the animal data.
For example, there were some pig studies that led to some of the interesting new recommendations for compressions-only CPR that showed that at least in the pigs, doing compressions only led to better outcomes, or that not stopping for the ventilations improved outcomes for the pigs, at least. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we actually did a literature review back in 2001 with some experts in the field of research. Dr. Paul Pepe was also co-chairing that committee with us at the Academy. And we finally published a paper on recommendations for dispatch in terms of the studies that we looked at, these animal studies. Now, we need to know that basically when you have a sudden collapse, there is still a fair amount of saturated oxygen in your bloodstream. Therefore, we need to start with compressions only, or at least compressions for an amount of time that would generally deplete the oxygen in your bloodstream before we start giving ventilations. We say this is continuous uninterrupted chest compressions, because we want to bring the pressure up in the coronary arteries, which we also call the coronary perfusion pressure. And you want to keep that pressure steady so that we can hopefully push more oxygenated blood into the heart muscle. And in counterpart, pushing that oxygenated blood, or at least what we can push through these coronary arteries that are still slightly opened, well, we've looked at other studies where keeping the heart viable with oxygenated blood for a longer period of time will maintain your specific waveform, which is called ventricular fibrillation. What is the ventricular fibrillation? It is the rhythm that appears when we look at the screen of the electrocardiogram. When we look at this, once the patient has suddenly collapsed. Now, this is a lethal rhythm. It's not a normal rhythm, and that would lead to a flat line if nothing is done to defibrillate this with a defibrillator.
Just to break in a little bit, I just want to say, in other words, what we're talking about here is that we want to maintain the heart at some sort of rhythm instead of letting it go into flatline, because once it's not beating at all, once it has no rhythm, the defibrillator is just not going to work. Is that kind of what you're getting at there?
Exactly.
And so that's interesting when we talk about the difference between compressions-based CPR, compressions first, compressions only CPR, versus kind of traditional CPR, which uses ventilations. Are there conditions for which the ventilations are still valuable?
Of course, there are all that we call an ex officio arrest, or we also call this a secondary cardiac arrest. It means that it's not the heart that stops, it's the breathing. You know, and just to give you a very, very clear example, you are 19 years old and you are underwater and you're drowning. Obviously, your heart is not sick. It's just that you're underwater and you're not breathing anymore. So if you're not breathing anymore, well, obviously your heart will stop eventually. So this is called an ex officio arrest. And basically we need to do a traditional CPR, which is two ventilations, and then go on with 30 compressions and then two ventilations, et cetera, until help arrives. So all other situations, like hanging, allergic reaction, suffocation, asthma, toxic inhalation, overdose, those are all situations which will bring on what we call an ex officio or a secondary cardiac arrest, which means that it's the breathing that stops first and not the heart.
Okay, so given the basic research that we have in resuscitation, how does all of this influence or relate to the MPDS? How does it come into being in the protocols?
Well, we know that basically after 4 to 6 minutes following a sudden collapse, you start to get irreversible brain damage. And also we also know that there is the numbers out there are not really specific, but we probably estimate that there is less than 5% of the population that's trained in CPR. So in terms of dispatch, this is very important that dispatchers are well trained in providing pre-arrival instructions for CPR over the phone. We've been talking about this since 1992, actually. We started talking about the importance of dispatchers providing these pre-arrival instructions on CPR. There was actually an article written by the American Heart Association, for which I was fortunate enough to be on the writing group, which is the scientific statement on dispatch-assisted CPR. So again, relating the importance of dispatchers being trained and performing quality improvement and quality assurance on these types of specific calls.
Well, our listeners are going to be interested in knowing what does this mean for them. So they know what ventricular fibrillation is. They might know what CPR is. They know that they have to give pre-arrival instructions. What parts of the research might be of interest to them, or what might they take back to their practice of emergency dispatching from knowing more about this basic research?
I guess that they're just going to be more proficient in giving out these instructions, knowing the importance of getting hands on chest compressions as quickly as possible because of that 4 to 6 minutes in terms of irreversible brain damage, and also to maintain a continuous uninterrupted chest compressions on the patient until the defibrillator arrives, and also knowing that basically when a patient suddenly collapses, goes into ventricular fibrillation, CPR will help maintain the viability of that heart to be defibrillated. Therefore, as soon as the defibrillator arrives, we need to get the defibrillator as quickly as possible, because we know that for every minute that CPR is delayed, we are diminishing the chances of survival by 10% for every minute that CPR is delayed.
And that continuous compressions that you mentioned, that's one of the things that's most important that we've learned relatively recently, that you can really do a lot of damage by leaving gaps in the compressions or by stopping compressions at any point. Is there anything dispatchers can do to help ensure that they're giving a continuous compression, that the caller doesn't gap?
Well, for one thing, in the protocol, we are specifically saying to the caller, count out loud so I can count with you. So basically, we have some tools in the protocol that help us maintain the rhythm. And basically, we have to encourage the caller to do the specific rhythm that we're looking for. And also the wording is very important in terms of saying push hard and fast. We need to push hard and fast, and we need to release the pressure completely from the chest wall in order to refill the heart, and also push hard to be able to push the blood out of the heart as forcefully as possible. So basically, that's really important for the dispatcher to know.
Okay, well, great. One last quick question for you, which is, you spend a lot of time thinking about CPR. You've done a lot of the research. You've been on a lot of these councils. What do you see as the future for CPR research?
Well, the future for CPR research, being on the board of directors of the Citizen CPR Foundation, there are some representatives or people that sit on the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation committees. And basically what they are telling us is that right now, as we speak, we used to have a review of the science and publication and dissemination of new guidelines every 5 years. Now, the International Liaison Committee has decided to look at a continuous update of the science and not specifically wait 5 years for any new compelling study that comes out year one, and then we have to wait 4 years in terms of releasing those guidelines. So it's going to be a process where, more specifically, it will be a continuous update of the science as we move along.
Well, great. Thank you so much for being with us today, Mark. And we look forward to our listeners checking in with us again next time. Thanks.
Okay, it's my pleasure.
To learn more about CPR and resuscitation science, check us out at aedrjournal.org. You can look at the American Heart Association website, which has some great videos on resuscitation, or look at the Citizen CPR Foundation's website, and that information will be in the show notes. See you next time for Dispatch in Depth. For more great content, please go rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcast.